The four words stood out in bold print. It looked like a pyramid there on that editorial page. Unusual shape monument made of words. At the top is a single letter word. Below it, a two letter word. Beneath that, four letters. And then at the bottom, six letters. Spelling I, me, mine, myself. Interestingly, it was placed within a frame, and on each side of the frame, you could read a statement familiar to all of us, sort of the mantra of our times. Do yourself a favor. I did it my way. You owe it to yourself. And if it feels good, do it. At the bottom of this so-called monument where the words looked as if they had been chiseled out of granite. Hundreds of people with their arms raised and hands held high as if they were worshiping at a shrine. At the base of this image, the words, speaking of American cults, jab, jab, twist, twist. Looking at that strange monument for a few moments, I felt sorry for our country. Not just for our country, but for our culture. It isn't just about American cult. It's about the world. The meism of our times is ubiquitous. It's in the sandbox as kids argue over the same toy. That's mine. No, that's mine. I want that. We want what we want, and we want it when we want it, namely now. The kids that go to school these days, now lack respect for their teachers. They even sass them, argue with them. It doesn't change when a bright student seeks a degree in higher education. Once again, that pride is imminent. The same is found in the salesperson seeking his or her quota for the month. Whoever you have to step on them. You see it in the life of physicians who should know better, being servants of the public. And I have to add, to my own embarrassment, even in the ranks of many in ministry, it's about me, my church, my people. And I have to add, politicians, local, statewide, and federal, find a humble one and you found a rare soul. That monument represents all greedy consumers. Has it always been so? I really believe that. I believe there was a day, and I would like to think even when I was a little boy, I heard patriotic words from my earliest years in my home. Serving in the military was an honor. Being a part of those who protect our God-given liberty was a treasure. The flag, always saluted. The national anthem, respected. I know I could sound like an old man here, even though I'm very young. But I love it that I come from that era. Cynthia and I often say to each other, weren't we blessed to have had so little of this world's goods and to have had so much from the mouths of our parents who mentored us. By the grace of God, we and so many around us were raised right. Something shifted in the 60s. It turned on its axis in the 70s. And before long, it seemed like even the one who held the office of president couldn't tell right from wrong. I asked Chuck Colson on one occasion, since he was the only one I knew who was near that Oval Office, what is it that's missing? His answer was very simple, but I believe it was accurate. Oh, so many of these days don't know right from wrong. That became Solomon's problem. Oh, he did early on. He did. 1 Kings chapter 3, you need to look at that before we look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2. This is a marvelous account of Solomon 40 years before he kept his journal in Ecclesiastes. He's a young man here. He's been raised right. His father David had been a good model, not perfect, admittedly. No one is perfect but our Lord and Master. But he had a good father who had modeled what it was to know God and walk with him. But now his father's reign is over and the scepter is passed to Solomon, David's greater son. Verse 5, we read of a dream Solomon had. That night, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream. I'm reading 1 Kings 3, 5. And God said, what do you want? Look at that question. Look at that. Open-ended. No condition. What do you want? And then he adds, ask and I will give it to you. Remarkable. Solomon replied, you showed faithful love to your servant, my father David, because he was honest and true and faithful to you, and you have continued your faithful love to him today by giving him a son to sit on his throne. Solomon respected his father. He looked back on his reign with joy, delight, honor. He says, now, O Lord, my God, you have made me king instead of my father David, but I'm like a little child who doesn't know his way around. And here I am in the midst of your own chosen people, a nation so great and numerous. they cannot be counted. Now look at what he asked for. Give me an understanding heart so that I can govern your people well and know the difference between right and wrong. What a statement. Make the line very clear, Lord, so I know where right ends and wrong starts. I've got to have that to lead correctly. For who by himself is able to govern this great people of yours? And look at the response. The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for wisdom. So God replied, because you have asked for wisdom in governing my people with justice and have not asked for a long life or wealth or even the death of your enemies, I will give you what you ask for. I will give you a wise and understanding heart, such as no one else has had or ever will have. And look at what he adds. And I will also give you what you did not ask for, riches and fame. No other king in all the world will be compared to you for the rest of your life. Look at that blessing that's promised Solomon. And if you follow me and obey my decrees and my commands, as your father David did, I will give you a long life. Solomon awakens and realizes what a magnificent thing this is. How blessed I am. And he's so young, and he will be given such wisdom. On top of that will be stacked immense wealth, enormous fame. You'll have it all, Solomon. But he warns him, be careful, be careful. Restrain yourself, lest you fall away from me. Look at chapter 11. Same book, 1 Kings chapter 11. I've now moved not quite 40 years ahead in time. Watch what happened. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women. Besides Pharaoh's daughter, he married women from Moab, Ammon, Edom, Sidon, and from among the Hittites. The Lord had clearly instructed the people of Israel, you must not marry them. Why? Because they will turn your hearts to their gods. Yet Solomon insisted on loving them anyway. And he had 700 wives of royal birth, 300 concubines. I read that the other day to Cynthia, and I said, you know what? He also got 700 mothers-in-law. And you don't read that in here, but that's part of it. And you don't get offended by that, please. It's a little lighthearted comment. You should have known my mother-in-law. Greater lady never walked the earth. We miss her to this day. Died in her mid-40s of breast cancer. If she were still alive, she'd be right here front row drinking this in. How she loved the Lord, as many mothers-in-law do, but Solomon's, I doubt that they did, these 700 wives from these idolatrous countries bringing all their idols in. In fact, it says, look at the end of the verse, in fact, they did turn his heart away from the Lord. After all the blessing, after the promise, after the answer, after watching God do exactly what he said he would do, he lost his moorings. And because of his interest in lots of different idolatrous women, he kicked over the traces, and that became his lifestyle. Even before then, he began to really lose restraint. Turn now to Ecclesiastes 2. As you turn, understand the drift that's occurred. G. Frederick Owen has written a fine book, Abraham to the Middle East Crisis, where he eloquently describes the sprawling unrestraint of Solomon's life. Listen to the way he flaunted his fame and fortune. I quote Owen, "Maddened with the love of show, Solomon swung into a feverish career of wastefulness, impropriety, and oppression. All Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and those of his house of pure gold. The shields of his mighty men were made of beaten gold, and his great throne was made of ivory overlaid with the finest gold. Solomon literally built himself a paradise of pleasure. On beautiful mornings, he often went in stately progress, dressed in snow-white raiment, riding in his chariot, made of the finest cedar, decked with gold and silver and purple, and carpeted with the costliest of tapestry worked by the daughters of Jerusalem, and attended by a bodyguard of 60 valiant men, the tallest and handsomest of the young men of Israel, arrayed in Tyrian purple, with their long black hair freshly sprinkled with gold dust, every day glittering in the sun." He goes on, "The verdict of history that wine and women are the cause of many a wrecked career is not far amiss in the story of Solomon's pathetic decline. His love for many women caused him to marry and pamper numerous foreign heathen wives who not only robbed him of his excellency of character, but dominated him and turned his heart to seek after other gods. Solomon, like many another absolute monarch, drove too fast and traveled too far. The monarch became debauched and effeminate, an egotist and cynic, so satiated with the sensual and material affairs of life that he became skeptical of all good. To him, all became meaningless, like chasing the wind." In another part of his work, he writes, "He drove his chariot to the misty flats of licentiousness, pride, and paganism." He had it all, and he ruined it all by turning after other gods. And by the way, the line between right and wrong became blurred. Before the end of his life, he's living in a whole world of wrong. So he goes on a search. He decides to try whatever means he can to get a little purpose back, since he would wake up morning after morning with that dark brown taste in his mouth and that burning headache after a night of revelry. So he thought he would try pleasures. I said to myself, by the way, look at the first person pronoun all the way through these 11 verses of Ecclesiastes 2. Reads like I, me, mine, myself. This is all about me. It's all about Solomon. Not a word about the Lord. I said to myself, come on, let's try pleasure. Let's look for all the good things and let's have a blast. His palace turned into an animal house. And he invites all his buddies and they come over night after night, day after day. Come on, I'll pick up the tab. It's on me. They look for all the things that will result in what he thought would be the good life. You can fill in the gaps with your imagination. The place must have rocked with laughter all through the night, stand-up comics, jesters and jokesters and jugglers, singers and strippers, and lavish feasts with wine and booze flowing like water. This will do it, if nothing else will. In fact, he says, I tried to experience the only happiness most people find in their brief life in this world. Don't go by that too quickly. That most people of that century is still true of this one. That's why every party is filled with booze. When you're rewarded, it's a bottle of booze. You're on the plane and you're flying first class, and they want to know, first of all, would you like a cocktail? More booze. Something to deaden the pain of an empty life. Here's Solomon. And plenty of food. Did a little research and found about the food. 1 Kings 4, 22 and 23. You want to hear his daily menu? Hold on. The daily food requirements for Solomon's palace were 150 bushels of flour, 300 bushels of meal, which would include grains of various kind, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, prime top-grade beef, 20 of them, 100 sheep or goats, as well as wild game like deer, gazelles, choice poultry, fattened to kill, fowl like duck, pheasant, geese, turkey, chickens. Haven't even mentioned the wine or the liqueur that would be a part of the party. One day, what a banquet. It's been estimated that that was enough food to feed from 10 to 20,000 people every day. Much of the food came from provinces nearby, as those governors around him brought in whatever the supply demanded. Don't miss, he tried to experience the happiness most people find during their brief life on this earth. For a moment, lest I sound harsh and judgmental, have a heart. I say again, that's all they know. They're raised with parents who stuff the refrigerator with booze. They're raised by those who don't know right from wrong and don't teach it. And they're taught in their higher education how twisted we are as a people, how strange we have become, how narrow to think in terms of right and wrong. So I tried to find meaning in building. Watch closely. I built huge homes for myself. Look at that. Not huge homes for the needy. Certainly there were those in Israel that were needy, but didn't have a heart for them. He built them for himself. One wasn't enough. 10 weren't enough. 20 weren't enough. So he built huge homes for himself. And then he planted beautiful vineyards, plural, vineyards. He made gardens and parks and filled them with all kinds of fruit trees, not natural to the land, because the land is a desert land. So in order to have trees, one must plant them. And in order to plant trees, one must have irrigation. So he says, I also built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate the many flourishing groves. Walt Kaiser writes a book titled Ecclesiastes, Total Life. And in it, he puts on the hat of an archaeologist and writes, the pools of water used to irrigate his young trees may be the traditional pools of Solomon, which are located several miles southwest of Jerusalem in the valley of Artas, A-R-T-A-S. There, huge reservoirs have been discovered, built of square stones and bearing marks of the highest antiquity, were set in the steep part of the valley. There are three pools measured in feet. They had the following sizes. Listen to the size of these reservoirs, which he dug or had dug for him. The lower pool was 582 feet in length. A football field is 300 feet. That's almost two football fields long, 50 feet deep. That's just one of the pools. The middle pool is 423 feet long. That's a football and a half field long, 39 feet deep. And the upper pool is 380 feet long, much longer than a football field, 25 feet deep. To these improvements, Kaiser writes, Solomon added many possessions. An account of Solomon's riches appears in 1 Kings 10, 14 to 29. So great was his fortune that silver and gold were soon to be regarded in Jerusalem as stones. In fact, he owned whatever he looked on, and his look went everywhere. It's a great line. But something was sadly missing. Not one of all those good things had brought him satisfaction or joy. Remember, Solomon, it all came from God. Remember 40 years earlier in that dream, ask what you wish, and I will give it to you. So he asked, and God gave. Solomon fell on his knees in humility and thanked the Lord his God. But he forgot that part about don't intermarry with those who will bring their gods with them into your palace, and they will turn your heart away from me. Solomon goes on to say that he collected great sums of silver and gold and the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers of men and women. Mixed choirs must have surrounded him as they sang in antiphonal voice. The music must have been magnificent. He had all of that. At the snap of his finger, they would sing. Whatever would be the song, probably one of his, he wrote over 1,000. Not to mention having written Proverbs. Think of this, by the way. At this time in his life, Solomon has written the Song of Solomon. He's written the 31-chapter book of Proverbs. And now he writes a journal. And it's a journal filled with sighs because he has left out the one most important ingredient, and that is the presence and the respect for the living God. Never forget that. This is for young and older alike. This is for whatever may be the race, whatever may be the geography, whatever may be your career, whatever may be your future. Never forget, it is all about keeping the Lord in first place and keeping yourself off the throne of your life. Solomon forgot all of that. And finally, he says that he has many beautiful concubines. Look at the end of verse 8. Talk about an eloquent statement. I had everything a man could desire. For a moment, we'll leave the journal and put ourselves outside the palace, away from Solomon's lifestyle, and we'll make ourselves one of the families seeing Solomon in all of his riches and fame and all of his possessions, all of his homes, and the temple he has built, the name he has made by the grace of God. And it would be easy for us, this little family living in a small, perhaps, one room with a dirt floor, thinking, oh, that's life. But here's the truth. Right from his own pen, this is the truth. If you were to get into the palace, and more importantly, into his head, this is what you would hear. I had everything a man could desire. I became greater than all who lived in Jerusalem. Anything I wanted, I would take. Look at the selfishness of that. I take it. That's mine. I don't have that. I want that. I denied myself no pleasure. I had everything a man could desire. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. He would be among those that people in film today would call the beautiful people. He would be among those whose life must be beautiful. Think of that word. Beautiful banquets in beautiful palaces with beautiful feasts and beautiful food. Outside the windows would be beautiful gardens with beautiful groves of trees, heavy with beautiful fruit. Beautiful choirs with beautiful mixed voices singing beautiful songs composed by the man himself. Beautiful women, thousands of them. Everything a person could ever dream of. And if that were not enough, he'd take more. But it wasn't beautiful. By that I mean it wasn't gratifying. This is what our children must hear. This is what our grandchildren must learn. They must learn what beauty is and isn't, what satisfaction is and isn't. They must learn that beautiful pleasures, as Solomon would call them, held out promises, but they had no staying power. They aren't with you when the bottom drops out of your life. You become diseased. Or your loved one dies. or your child is taken. Nothing beautiful about the pleasures of the sensual life. Sensual pleasures offer to open our eyes, but in fact they blind us. During my almost 25 years in the Los Angeles area, ministering there among some great people, it was often my lot to have my phone ring. The voice on the other end would be someone I didn't know, and they had heard of something that I had maybe written or something that I'd said, they'd listened to, or someone had told them about, and they wanted to know if I would talk to them. Often they were surprised to hear me say, of course. Sometimes they would even come. And walking through the door of my study, some of the most heartbreaking sights you could ever see after the fact. None of them, when they came to me, looked beautiful. They looked broken. First, their heart was broken. Next, their lives were broken. Their reputations were broken. I spoke with male prostitutes. I spoke with people who made their living on the street. I spoke with those who had committed crimes that had to be reported, facing trials as a result of taking advantage of others. I spoke to those who had built fortunes out of their corporations and the emptiness of their souls. Not one of them came in with a smile. Their lives were absolutely empty. I used to say to people, if folks could see the individuals I see who are just thinking about getting into drugs, it would make all the difference in the world, I think, because you would see the other side of it. I saw it in the Marine Corps where men would come back from the village with a disease. Most of them married men, carelessly living their lives as if there's no tomorrow, and then having to face taking that disease to their wife when they go home. It isn't beautiful. It's empty. It's vacant. It's heartbreaking. Had a lady call me on one occasion, and she said to me, I want you to know I just heard you on the radio. I didn't know that I could ever get through to you. Can't believe I'm talking to you. She said, I was in a hotel. I went there to kill myself. And she said, I can still taste the steel in my mouth from the pistol. And she said, all of a sudden, the radio clicked on. And of all things, somebody before me, I guess, had set the radio to come on at that particular time. And there you were, as she put it, there you were yelling on the radio. And I said, yeah, that's probably me. And she said, but I got to tell you, I took the gun out of my mouth. And I got to know this person you keep talking about. She talked about her life and lifestyle. She's not only a mother, she's a grandmother. She bought the lies and come to an end. She realized that sensual pleasures make us appear satisfied and successful, but in fact, the truth is they lead to a vacancy and emptiness and a heartbreak. It can't be put into words. I got her in touch with our ministry, and hopefully they followed through, as they always do, with as best we could help them through Insight for Living. So grateful that we had that to offer them, hope through Christ. I'll never forget one man who came, and he was an empty shell. I could smell him as soon as he came in. He'd been living on the street. He was at wit's end. And he just wanted to see if I was real. And he sat down and he said, I won't take much of your time. I just want to tell you what you can tell people. And then he unloaded. And he talked like a guy that had been living in the street. When he got all through, he said, here, I'm going to give you something. I've carried this a long time. Maybe you'll be able to use it someday. He said, I don't know who the guy is, but if you want to use it, you're free to use it. I don't know where it's from. It's about a guy named Richard Corey. And he just got up and he walked out. This is what it said. Whenever Richard Corey went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean, favored, and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked. But still, he fluttered pulses when he said, good morning. And he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In truth, we thought that he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked and waited for the light and went without the meat and cursed the bread. And Richard Corey, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head. This fast lane living isn't all it's set up to be. It's a lie. The journey with Christ is the only journey worth taking, regardless of the hardships, and the trials, and the losses, and the hindrances, and the misunderstandings. The rewards await us. But the best part is you go to sleep every night with a clear conscience. Unlike Richard Corey. Will you be nice enough to bow your head, please? Wherever you are, watching online, wherever you may be sitting, among us here, just make your lap into an altar. Come before the Lord. There's a cross in that altar. The cross is a place of sacrifice. And that's what Jesus did when he died for you and for me. He knew our life would be empty without him. He knew the cost of sin. And he knew that some would not choose the right way, but he left us with a choice. You may have chosen incorrectly most of your life. Now's the time to make the right choice. Trust Christ. The one who died on that cross for you looks up to you and says, believe in me. Trust me. Let me come into your life and change you. I have purpose and meaning to add to the emptiness that you have found. But you can't get it without knowing me. And I'm ready to provide it along with eternal rewards, security, purpose, joy, fulfillment, compassion, and a ministry to others. He won't force his way in. He waits for you to invite him to come in. Invite him in now. Now. And then connect with us. We want to help you in the journey from earth to heaven. It's a narrow path, and it will include sacrifice and leaving your way and embracing God's way, but it'll be worth every moment. Start today. Thank you, Father, for speaking to us. I pray that you will change lives as a result of what has been shared, and that you will reveal the emptiness of a life attempted to be lived without you. And having done so, humble that life so that that individual will trust in you. Like my friend in the motel that night who turned her life over to you. I ask this through Christ, our Savior. Everyone said, amen. Thank you.